Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the intersection between who we are and where we come from? Molly Caro May has moved a lot, from Australia, where she was born, to the Dominican Republic, then Spain and Mexico. In the U.S., she lived in North Texas and also in Florida, and those moves happened when she was a kid. In her adult life, she kept the pattern going, making temporary homes in South Africa, New Mexico, New York, and New Zealand, among other places, all before she was 30 years old. But then a strange thing happened. After a lifetime of defining herself as a nomad, she found a home and an identity she hadn't realized she'd been looking for in the process of building what was meant to be an entirely temporary dwelling on some land her parents owned in Montana. The new memoir by author Molly Caro May is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Molly, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your moves as a kid. One could be forgiven for assuming that your parents were in the Foreign Service or something, but as it turns out, your dad worked for Colgate-Palmolive and just liked to move.
He did. He grew up moving every 2 or 3 years as a child himself. So it was really sort of an ethical and lifestyle choice for him. He felt like it was important to have his kids exposed to lots of places. And my mother, who was from Wisconsin, was up for the adventure. So we moved every 2 or 3 years. He worked for Colgate, and he spoke Spanish and also a little bit of Russian. So that's primarily why we were in Spanish-speaking countries.
So many people who move a lot as kids, you know, military kids, mm-hmm. They talk about, you know, the advantages of learning to, you know, get yourself in with a new group of friends, but also the challenges. It doesn't sound like as a child you thought it was challenging at all.
I did not. I think my parents prepped me really well, and I thought it was fun to start again, to be new in a place. And my brothers and I became very comfortable with that. And, you know, we were third culture kids, which means we went to schools, international schools, with a bunch of other children who were living the same sort of lives we were. My best friend in Spain was a little boy, Nader, who was from France and Vietnam. And he was probably going to move in 2 or 3 years, too. So it was very familiar for us in that way.
It was when you were living in Dallas that you actually discovered that you could sort of cash in on this fact that you've moved all over. You told your friends, maybe not so truthfully, that you'd had a pet koala, and suddenly you were the coolest thing instead of just the new girl.
Absolutely. That was a big moment because I suddenly felt like this foreign creature who people wanted to know about. People were interested in, and I hadn't seen myself as anything other than what I was, and suddenly I was different from them. And so I really built an identity around that up until recently.
I think it's so interesting because nothing very interesting happened in my childhood, but I would have loved to have something like that that made me different. And I totally relate, even though I didn't have that thing, to that need, especially when you're really young and you haven't quite figured out who you are yet, to have like a thing that you can hang on to.
It is something that differentiates us. I think we all want that. And, we grow into adults who do this. My brother has this great line where he says, you know, we're all trying to find the thing that gets us loved, and it could be anything. It could be that you're really beautiful or that you're smart or that you grew up all over the world, and then you use that. And that's what I use, that I grew up all over the world.
As you got older and you were in control of where you lived and moved, what would tell you that it was starting to be time to go to a new place?
I think it was really this period of time. It was about a year and a half that would pass, and then I would start feeling this itchy thing, and my feet would start wanting to move. And I was really trying to sort of remake myself in new places often, or find a new experience, authentically really find a new experience. I still seek that.
You're candid about the fact that eventually you came to understand that it wasn't maybe the place that you were discontented with, but it was yourself.
Absolutely. You know, I think we all try to find a person, a place, a new job, something that's new in an effort to remake ourselves. But for me, that's really what living on this land and living in this elemental structure gave for me. It forced me, not forced, it invited me to be pared down in a way that the only thing I could really do was look within. And that's what I discovered why am I hiding behind this? You know, what is this about? And why do I have to always find this next best thing? What would happen if I didn't look for that?
So when you say I'm going to go to some land that my parents own and build myself a yurt, it sounds like you had a lot of friends who were like, well, good for you. But a lot of people would think that is a crazy decision. How did you frame explaining that choice to people that you'd known throughout your life?
It's a great question. My husband, Chris, and I have friends who did not think it was strange, though they were making different choices. But for other people, you know, we were 30. It was not a smart financial choice. We had left our jobs in New York City, and here we were going to build a yurt and live in it with no real plan beyond that. And so I told people that for me, I really wanted to live in a way that felt alive. And for me, that was not sitting in an office at a job for the rest of my life, for me.
So for people who haven't been to like the steppes of Central Asia, can you describe mm-hmm. the physical structure of a yurt and how it's meant to be put together if you do it the traditional way?
Absolutely. Yeah, we modeled our yurt after a traditional Mongolian ger, that's what it's called, but we called it a yurt. And it is made of lattice walls that are wooden walls, and then roof poles that look sort of like jousting sticks made out of wood. And we had 60 of those attached to the walls, and they shot up to the center where there's a circular skylight called a tono. That's it. And then we covered that with some insulation and then some canvas, just teepee canvas. And that's the structure. So we could put the yurt up and take it down in about an hour, which is how it's originally designed to be. You know, people who use yurts and live in yurts are nomadic people, and they move with the grasses and their herds.
Putting it up and taking it down within an hour is one thing. Constructing it in the first place is another thing entirely.
Absolutely. I had this vision that it was going to take us 3 weeks to a month to build, and it took us much longer. Not much, but 3 months. And my husband is a carpenter. He was very familiar with how to do all of this, but I wasn't. And it's not really my pace. I'm not a slow, sort of patient person. And there was a lot of repetitive movement, a lot of sanding. And for me, that it really required a few deep breaths, more than a few. But that also clued me into this feeling that, why am I rushing this too? What do I want? Now I want to live in the yurt, not just build the yurt. What's that about? And so I did a lot of questioning during that time.
It seems there are two kinds of people, because there are people who, it sounds like maybe your husband, just glory in the process and they mm-hmm. can be in the moment. And then there are people who you've already visualized what it'll be like to have your cozy little home in there. And I think it's good for everybody to get on the other side of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my husband, Chris, has really pushed me to look at that side, his side of things, or that side of being in the moment. And I think I've encouraged him to look at the visioning side. That's one thing that I can do well and that I love doing, is imagining what can be and feeling really not limited by anything. But, you know, then once I moved into the yurt, there was a whole other set of things of now we need to really know how to cook food in the yurt. Let's figure that out. So it's continual.
Yeah, it seems like it was a whole, you know, several months of just learning new skills and problem solving. And like, you can't Google, how do I get a 350-pound wood stove up a snowy hill without a vehicle? You have to just figure that out.
Exactly. That's a great detail. And that was a big one. You know, we had friends come and help us strap a rope. A climber friend tied some important knots, and we pulled this really heavy wood stove up this hill that I describe in the book. It feels like a tidal wave when you're standing at the bottom of it. It is steep. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes to walk straight up it. And we pulled that thing up just through our, you know, the power of our arms, in the hopes that the rope wouldn't snap and the stove wouldn't go careening down the hill and hurt someone, really.
How did you choose the site where you would put the yurt initially?
We did a lot of walking around the land, and we wanted to be up high. There's a plateau on the land. You know, you walk up this hill and then there's a plateau. And that feels actually very close to the steppes of Central Asia. We are surrounded by five mountain ranges, snowy peaks most of the year, and the winds are ripping through there. The elk come up there and they sit and enjoy the sun, the owls, the eagles. And we wanted to be up there looking down over the valley, but tucked in against the trees because we knew the winds would be really strong. And they were.
For people who imagine that it must have been freezing all the time, Mongolia is even colder than Montana. And I was really surprised to find that your heating system initially worked too well.
It did work too well. We had the yurt was about 200 square feet and small. And our wood stove, once we got it cranking, the first night, I think we got it to about 90 degrees. We had a little thermometer in there. And it was really hot. So we would be in this little hot zone and then open the door to go outside. And, you know, you'd be blasted by this winter weather. And that, living in those sort of extremes, was really dynamic. And I miss that. I don't live in the yurt anymore. And I really miss that sense of being so connected to the elements.
Yeah, like you're protected from the elements, but you can't possibly be isolated from them.
Exactly. You're protected, but you can't. I do write in the book that I could have put a pickle jar outside and still smelled, you know, an open pickle jar and smelled the pickle juice from the inside. We heard coyotes, owls, animals brushing against the yurt, wind, everything.
I really appreciate your candor in this, because you could frame this story as if it was just you and Chris and you were completely isolated. But in the same way that Thoreau never claimed to be completely alone at Walden, there were neighbors, there were friends dropping by. How did you balance your sense that you guys really were kind of out on your own and the idea that you were still interacting with people on a fairly regular basis?
That was important for me. I went to town. We live near town Bozeman. It's a big town, 60,000 people, university town, 20 minutes away. And so we were not isolated. And I wanted, when I wrote the book, I wanted to say that very clearly. You know, this was not, we had no intention of being, quote, you know, badasses out there and doing something to prove a point. We didn't really need to prove any points. But so I would often go into town. Our UPS driver, Brooks, was around a lot. Our neighbors, Diane and Willem, helped us when we got snowed in and we couldn't get out. And however, when we went up into the yurt, and there was a cabin on the land that we used for the bathroom and to store many of our things. And when we went up in the yurt, that was actually very isolating. We couldn't see any other houses from up there. I spent 3 weeks by myself up there when Chris was out of town. And I didn't really go into town much. And that was... I did feel like I was in my own little world, and that was important for me to feel that.
Does your writing change when you have that much time just within your own head?
Yes, it gets very simple.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Simple to write, or your writing just is very clear and simple?
Simple words. You'd think it would be the opposite, in the sense of you're sort of in your head and everything goes crazy, but I think when, you know, when I'm alone, or when I was alone in that instant... or that instance, that there's a pulling in that happens, and you get pared down, sort of like the wind brushes by, and it creates this simplicity around you, and your words match that. My words match that.
We're speaking with author Molly Carrow May. Her new memoir is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Molly Caro May. Her new memoir is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. She'll speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Your parents owned the land that you put the yurt on. How did you decide to ask them if you could use it for a while? And when? What did you tell them your intention was?
We wanted to caretake the land. So I said to my parents, no one's living there. We need a place to go. And we want it to be near the mountains. And what would you think if we went there and took care of it? You know, for a small, a short portion of time. And then we got there and decided we wanted to build a yurt, and then that was a whole other piece. So we wrote a proposal to my brothers and my parents and said, this is an impermanent structure, and we'd like to live here for a little bit, and in exchange, deal with fallen trees and make sure the cabin's good to go.
Was it more work to take care of the land than you thought it would be?
Not especially. It was really just having a presence there. And we did cut down a lot of trees that were dead or dealt with those types of things. But it wasn't a lot of caretaking. For going up the hill, we mowed down by hand with shears a huge section just to make it passable for people. And little pieces like that. But I think our real intention was that my family had come every once in a while. This is a place my parents bought with the intention of creating a home base for our family. We didn't have one, and they wanted a place for all of us to gather. And so we wanted to create the energy of that place, or to say, come, let's make something happen here.
Your brother-in-law, your husband's brother, came to visit, and he is something of a globetrotter himself. And he said he had concluded that the best part about traveling was coming home. And I get the sense that at the time you were like, what, are you crazy? But it stuck with you.
It did stick with me. And at the time, I did feel that. He had just come back from traveling all through the Middle East and in Syria. And I could sort of smell it on him. You know, he was talking about all these things he had done. And here I had been in this place for what felt for me like a very long time. And I was starting to get antsy again. But I do agree. I think the place I've come to now is that I want a home base. I know this is the place I've come to. I want a home base, a home place for my daughter, for my family, for me. And the pact I've made with Chris, my husband, is that every 6 to 7 years, we will go somewhere else for a year. I need that. But I had this elder tell me, he said, you know, be a bard, be someone who has a home place but goes other places. Because if you don't have a place to be from, what do you have to share with people? That was his point.
I love the way you describe your husband throughout the book. And you don't so much describe him as just sort of talk about how he responds to you. And sometimes he just keeps his mouth shut and lets you, you know, talk on and on. And other times he'll, you know, put a well-placed comment here and there. And, you know, nobody's perfect. But it seems like you found in him something very different from yourself. And I wonder, that can be so wonderful, and also it can be really frustrating for both parties sometimes.
Absolutely. It's both. You know, this is a man who was raised in one house for 18 years in the western part of Maine, and he is flexible and he's able to go anywhere, but he has this great sense of rooting and also a great sense of calm. But with that comes a lot of what I would call silence in times when I want more conversation, yeah, or I want more of that dynamic back and forth. And so it's both, you know, and I know that what I've offered to him and what we did together in the yurt was this dance between calm and silence and then energy and excitement and back and forth, back and forth.
Was it challenging because as a carpenter, he had the skills to put everything together. So you ultimately were like his assistant making the yurt. Mm-hmm.
That for me is a challenging position.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He's a great teacher and I listened, but it's not my skill and it's not a place I want to be, covered in wood dust with earplugs and masks on. It's not what I enjoy. So that did create some tension for us. Absolutely.
It's a fascinating exercise in patience that I gather you didn't necessarily approach the project expecting to subject yourself to. But, you know, if you make a mistake, you just have to go back and do it until it's right, or else the whole thing won't come together, which in some ways is like a beautiful metaphor for marriage.
It is a great metaphor for marriage. We had this one moment, or I had this one moment, where I was tying all the lattice walls together, and I did it the wrong way. And so I had to untie these tight knots that I'd created. And I was so frustrated sitting there on the lawn doing this, but then found the calm and redid it. And, you know, why frustrated? I don't know, because it was going to take another 4 or 5 hours. And that is a great metaphor for marriage, this constant sort of maintenance, but also giving, letting go.
Did time move in a different way for you during the construction period in particular?
Yes, everything was very slow, and everything was very slow in general with living in the yurt. We had cell phones that worked well in the yurt, but we didn't use them that often. We would hike up there, we would make dinner, and we would just sit, literally just sit from 7 o'clock until we went to bed, doing nothing, reading books, talking. I mean, I think that's almost unthinkable for a lot of people these days, especially with technology. So that was such a gift, and that created a real slowness for us.
You ran into some friends that you'd been really close to, you and your husband, in college, and they were like suddenly addicted to their iPhones and, you know, still lovely people. But that must have been a strange experience to realize that you had not moved into reliance on technology the way really the rest of your generation had.
Absolutely. That happened when we were building our yurt. That's when all of our friends got iPhones, everything exploded. And that moment with our friends, for me, was really a grief moment. And I don't mean that lightly. I mean that really seriously. I felt like I'd lost something with them, and continue to lose things with people. And even with myself, I now have an iPhone. I'm not even sure that I want it, but I do. And there are benefits. I see that it's all a tool, but I wonder. And I feel like I had this little moment in time that continues to be my teacher. That moment in time of living in the yurt is a teacher for me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Fort Worth. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, how you doing? I love your subject. I like your guest. I grew up in the military until I was 16, and there are advantages and disadvantages. What I found, because once I was out of the military, once my father retired in 78, I found I was like a fish out of water. People would ask me where I'm from, and I would say, well, I'm not from Fort Worth. I live here now, but I wasn't born here. I traveled around the world like every 3 years in the military. And my parents, they're in a different situation. They were stable. They got married like at 19 and 21, but up until then, they had a foundation until they were like 19 and 21, and then they got married. But me, I traveled all. So my question is, how much did her husband teach her to, in different situations where, you know, I'm African American. I found that I grew up with my parents. They were African American, but I was just felt like a fish out of water. So how much did her husband teach her to interact with society? Because I believe there's disadvantages and there are advantages traveling around.
Thanks for your call.
Really great question. Thank you. You know, I hear what you're saying. It can be really disorienting to not have a place to be from. And part of what I write about in the book is that I did come to an understanding that I really missed that. And I did want a home. And I had wanted a home, just like you, when I was young, or wanted to be able to say that I was from a place and really understand what that meant. And I do think being partnered with my husband, he did give me a different viewpoint, but also it sort of gave me a foil so that I felt different from him in the sense of, well, that was his experience. But there is a real beauty in being someone who moves every 3 years and has this wealth of understanding of what it means like to move. It's both and. It's disorienting, but it's also a real enlightening place to come from.
I wonder if having traveled to lots of places, lived in lots of places, even for, you know, a year or even a few months at a time, it's hard to pick a home because, like, you're maximizing. Like, what if Montana is not the best place? What if I should be on a mountainside in Hawaii? Or what if I should be in South America? Like, did you have to get to a place where you realized at a certain level, the place doesn't even matter?
Absolutely, yeah. It's important. That one's really important because I felt like I was addicted, like many people of my generation, but especially the way my lineage sort of ran through my blood. I was addicted to this idea of something is better in the next place. And, well, Montana's great, but in Hawaii I could have this and it would be warmer and there would be an ocean with dolphins. I mean, you could go on and on. And at some point, I don't know if it was stage of life being in my early 30s, but I had this feeling like, maybe it could have been anywhere where we landed, but I think I was having this natural drive to send a taproot down somewhere and see what happened.
I can only speak to my own experience, but I do think that the 30s are really a huge generation of growth for women in particular. Like, it's this decade where you change in ways that are not so much scary as just elemental.
Yes. Yes. And elemental is it. That for me, being, I'm now 35, so I spent the last 5 years in Montana. I've had a child, and it was, I am who I am. I'm the same person I was when I was 25. I'm the same person I was when I was in New York, but I do have a much deeper sense of self and a deeper sense of grounding. And part of that is where I live, and part of that is just growing up. Mm-hmm. I hope it continues.
Did your peripatetic years when you were moving from place to place, did that pattern affect the way you made friends and the kinds of people with whom you made friends?
I haven't thought about that before, that specifically. I'm always drawn to people who are a little bit, well, I'm drawn to people who are similar to me, but I'm drawn to people who have something that I find interesting. You know, you grew up where? What happened for you? Or you want to go where? So I think anyone that I'm really close to has a real thirst and hunger for other places, other people, other things, and across the board.
Do you live in a regular house now or like a traditional structure?
I do. Chris, my husband, built us a house, a small house on the land after our daughter was born. And we live there now, and it is wonderful, and we have a bathroom, and we have a kitchen, and it's not fully finished, but it's a real house. And however, I was just telling someone this morning that even though we live on the land, same place, not same spot, but same place, we've lost that sense of the elemental, because when I sleep at night, I hear the owls hoot, but I don't feel the wind. I hear it, but I don't feel it in the same way I did in the yurt.
How did you make the decision that you wanted a more permanent structure?
I think I got to the place where I knew that Montana was where I wanted to root down and create a home place. And we were pregnant, and our daughter lived with us in the yurt for 3 months, and then that was enough. And I wanted a home. I think I've always wanted to create home. I just didn't know what that looked like.
I'm curious about your approach to stuff, because if the yurt is, what did you say, 20 by 20 approximately, and it's a circle, you can't have a lot of possessions in there before the place is just overrun. So how did you decide what went with you and what you could live without?
We don't have a lot of stuff, and we kept some of it in the cabin. Most of the stuff we have is outdoor-oriented, bikes, boots. Mm-hmm. I have 2 bags of clothes. I wish I had more clothes, actually, because I'm starting to like them more than I used to. But I really, living a pared down and simplified life is really important to me. I feel that way as a parent, too. I don't want a lot of toys around. I can't handle it. It's too much. It clogs my mind. And I think we all feel that. You know, we have moments where, oh, I'm feeling frustrated. I'll clean with the kitchen. Then I'll feel better. And so in terms of what we kept, we didn't have much to begin with. So now it's more a question of, you know, what do we want to add and what don't we want to add?
Have you kept up with, like, what's called the tiny house movement?
Yes.
I would imagine there are some things that you can relate to, but now there are all these TV shows and it seems so very weirdly prepackaged, this thing that started as a movement that felt very sincere.
Yes. And now it's, it's sort of amplified. It's this thing that people wanted to, oh, how cool, tiny house. I only, you know, I sleep with my legs curled up because that's what I do. And I think the intention is really good and mm-hmm. pure to say, you know, how big a space do we actually need? But yeah, now it's all over the place and we've got these TV shows. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because if it sort of pulls into the mainstream media in a way that people, it really asks people to question how they live, that's good.
You had not a conversation with your father, but a dream about a conversation with your father that didn't actually happen. And he sort of, in your dream, spoke to you. Can you talk about what he said in that dream?
Yes, that was a pivotal moment for me. He essentially told me that I had, you know, I'd built this idea that I was this global girl, woman from all over the world. And he essentially told me in the dream, you know, you didn't make those choices. You were a child and you just came along. And so, and your grandparents grew up in Chile. They didn't grow up all over the world, but you've created this story for yourself that is true. However, it isn't fully true in the way that you've sculpted it. You aren't as global as you think. And for me, that was devastating. I woke up from this dream thinking, hold on a second, what's going on? Am I not who I think I am? Do I not want what I think I want? And what I came to was, you know, I've been telling myself this story about myself in an effort to feel okay and to feel like I am enough. And we all struggle with this question of, you know, am I enough? And what are the things I can add on to who I am to feel like I am enough? And that was what I added on.
It's interesting. Of course, anything you dream is really coming from your own brain. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that you assigned that to your father, that sort of wisdom. Did you wake up like angry with him?
That's great. No, I didn't. I think he sort of would have said something like that to me anyway, in a mm-hmm. kind way. He's a kind person. So I can see him. He'll often say to me, he'll say all sorts of things, but no. I was not mad.
We're speaking this hour with author Molly Caro May. Her new memoir is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. She's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Molly Caro May. Her new book is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So there was a point at which you guys didn't have a lot of money, and your husband thought about, shooting animals for meat. And can you talk a little bit about how you both thought about this and how you made the decision that it was something you might want to do and what it felt like when it actually happened?
Yes. I had been a vegetarian most of my life, and not necessarily because I had any sort of political view about eating meat as a child. I just didn't like the taste. But I'm really sensitive to animals. You know, if a moth is, I write in the book about a moth dying in my shower and picking it up on a piece of toilet paper and taking it outside so it can live. You know, that's just who I am. But Chris had taken a hunter safety class. He'd hunted before. He'd never shot an animal. This is when we lived back on the East Coast. But it's very much part of the life in Montana. You know, people hunt, and they hunt for meat. They don't hunt as, you know, sport hunting. And there are elk and deer all over the place. So we talked a lot about it, and We talked about what it would feel like for him to actually shoot an animal. He's also really sensitive. I didn't feel like that was something I wanted to do. I had no interest in that. But I wanted to partake in the helping of whatever we would do with the animal once it was shot. And so he did shoot a deer, his first deer, on the land, called me. I was on my way home, and we had to learn how to process this animal. And so we, took the skin off and we hung it, and then we took the muscles off, and it was an amazing, I've done it a few times now, an amazing experience of being invited into this physical structure that is just like ours on a lot of levels, that is so organized, has such design, is beautiful. And for me, seeing the cavity of this deer, the rib cage, it brought all sorts of philosophy up for me about what it meant to be contained as a person and what it meant to hold myself within. So we still do that.
You describe it, the butchering process, as both sacred and mundane, which is, I've been thinking about that ever since I read the passage, because it's just a really amazing way to think about this. It's been happening, since humans were able to hunt, and yet it's extraordinary every time.
Exactly. It is mundane in the sense that you're cutting off body parts and putting them in bags and figuring out where you're going to put the gut pile, and it's so clear that the spirit is no longer in the animal. It is so clear, which for me was, we're not exposed to death. At least I haven't been as a child much in this culture. And so that was wild to see that. And the sacred piece is that you're killing an animal, you're taking a life, and then you're eating the meat. I mean, you're taking that flesh, and then it's helping you create more flesh of your own. What is more sacred than that?
Living on a piece of land that is not developed in the way that like a big subdivision would be or whatever, there's a lot of wildlife around and it's beautiful. It can be scary too. How did you come to terms with the fact that there might be a bear or a mountain lion right outside your, at the time, temporary structure?
This was a big one for me. I had constant fear of the, in quotes, the mountain lion. We saw her tracks, I call it a her. We saw her tracks often. We never saw her. People who came to visit us would see her running. It could have been the same one, I don't know, or a different mountain lion. And we had to be really wise. You have to pay attention. I couldn't walk up the hill always by myself. Sometimes I did. Without screaming and having a singing with a flashlight, because you can be mistaken for a deer at night. However, a mountain lion doesn't want to eat you. They don't want to eat you. They want to eat deer. So if they were to attack you, it would be a mistake. But bears, we don't have grizzly bears down there, but we have black bears. We saw them a lot. And the beautiful part of that is that you become so hyper-tuned to your environment, because you have to be, because you are not on the top of the food chain. And I still struggle with that, because I don't feel my sense of freedom in the mountains is limited in that way, but I feel so alive.
People have been doing that forever, and like it's only the past few generations that we've not had that. It's funny to me to think about how little most of us connect with like the stars. Either we live in cities and we just can't see them, or we're under a roof all the time at night and we catch a glimpse of them from the car window.
Exactly. And we were under the stars all the time and had this constant sense of animals moving around us. And when that happens, when you don't feel like you're the only creature in your environment, you feel small, to use a cliche. You feel small, but it's small in a good way. You have a sense of a deeper planetary thing happening. And I do think as a culture, well, we all know that as a culture, we've lost that.
Did anything ever get into the yurt? I'm thinking about like my experiences, especially after I had kids, like discovering that there was a rodent or a particularly scary insect like anywhere, in range of my kids. It could be really off-putting in a way that caused me to like overturn all my values about how animals are to be treated and that sort of thing.
Right. We didn't have any rodents, surprisingly. We didn't have any mice come in, but I would be in the summer, I'd be sitting with the door open, writing at my desk, and a whole flocks of birds, tiny little birds, would fly into the yurt, fly around, and then fly out. That was mystical, to just be sitting there and go, whoa, what just happened? So,
did you worry at all about fire? Is there a fire hazard in a yurt?
Sure. The wood stove could, something could happen. But we didn't. thing. It's so small that mm-hmm. if there was a fire, we would be out the door in 2 seconds. But the wind pushed, you know, was so strong, and the wood stove often would rattle at night. And those nights we were very awake watching it, nervous.
And you have to get up through the night and feed a wood stove.
Yes. So every 4 hours, one of us would have to get up and we would take turns. And it was sort of, maybe it was prep for having a child.
Except the wood stove stops crying
right,
once you put a log
exactly.
in there.
So we were very alive to the fire, having to tend all the time.
When you started sitting down to form this experience into a narrative that you would share with other people, there must have been things as you wrote that you hadn't realized until the moment that you wrote them.
Yes. I had taken a journal the whole time, or kept a journal, because I thought maybe one day I would do something with it. But when I initially told my writers group and a few agents I was talking to that I had this, you know, oh, I've been living in a yurt, I don't know, they all said, that's amazing, you should write a book about that. And my first thought was, oh, please, that's so cliche, or it's so sweet and saccharine, I don't know. And I really had to open myself to the thought that this had importance for me as the writer, for my own growth, but also in the hopes that one person somewhere in the world would be touched by it. And so as I was writing it, I did come to many points. The deer is one of them, where in the moment of butchering that deer, I totally knew what was happening in terms of me connecting to the cavity, but I didn't have a whole sense of the whole narrative to know what that would mean until I wrote it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the conclusions that you came to overall was that nobody's identity is any one thing. Like, we're all, you know, you can simultaneously be the woman who traveled all over the world and this person who is now laying down roots in Montana. And that's a big deal to realize that you can be more than one thing, and you can be something now and it doesn't negate what you were in the past.
Mm-hmm. I think about this a lot. We love to label. I love to label. It's part of how we categorize our world. And I labeled myself, I categorized myself, and it was so liberating to say, oh, hold on a second. I do want a home, but I also want to be out and about and wandering, and I can be all of those things, or I can choose one. And it doesn't change me in the core as a person. It just means that I'm evolving.
So someone who has struggled with being impatient at times, you know, you had this experience of building a yurt. I feel like nothing takes your time out of your personal control like raising an infant. And I wonder if you drew on having learned that time was not really yours to control anymore when your daughter was quite young.
Mm. I'm still learning that. She's almost two. And, you know, people often will say, oh, well, you asked this question, what is enough, in the book, and you found your answer, which I sort of did at the end, but it's not so tidy, you know.
Right.
Life is not so tidy. And then I had a child, and then I had a whole new question of what is enough, and what's enough sleep, and what's enough beingness, and my time, and who am I anymore, and when do I get to write, and who am I as a woman, not only a mother, all these questions. I'm still living those through. So, however, I do feel like that slowness allowed me, and that connection to the land did set me up in a way to be able to tap in when I needed to, not always, but when I needed to tap into that grounding.
Are your parents nearby now?
They are. They moved to the cabin right when they moved to the cabin, and then we were pregnant. They didn't move there because we got pregnant, but so they live there very close to us, which is a whole other set of amazing and also complicated pieces, because now the land is really occupied, and that's lovely. It's really lovely.
There's an interesting thing, I think, about getting to know your parents if they're very close by as an adult, and you discover things about them that maybe never occurred to you in the, you know, all-encompassing narcissism of childhood. And that's not about you. It's about every kid I've ever met.
Yes. And we're developing new relationships as adults now, especially now that Chris and I are parents, because they're watching us parent and they're becoming grandparents. So for me, it's a real gift, because I was never the kind of child who said, oh, I'm going to live close to my parents. If anything, it was the opposite, not because of any quality of my parents, just because I wanted to be on my own, forging my own way, independent. And now here I am living, you know, 300 yards away from them. But it's giving me a lot.
How do you write? When do you write?
I write standing up often. That has been a new development for me in the past few years. Really important. I move a lot when I write because I'm finding a real connection between movement and writing in terms of what comes out. And also for body health.
Sitting is the new smoking.
Right. Sitting isn't working for anyone. So, and now I write about 6 hours a week. That's the time that I have because I'm also a teacher. And I write wherever I can find the time. I carve out hour, 2 hour chunks and I just get to it. It's like a job for me. Of course, I'm inspired throughout the week and I write notes and I write at night, but it's very systematic.
At different points throughout the book, you share lists that you have made, things you wanted to achieve, and they're often really interesting and sometimes they're kind of funny. Are you still a list maker?
Totally. Yes. I mean, I could show you my list right now in my bag. There's something about that organization. My lists always look messy. My handwriting is messy, but it makes me feel falsely in control of what's happening. And it also helps me vision. So it's important for me to have lists.
I like your list, though, because they're about things like, you know, ways to really improve yourself. And mine are like, don't forget, we need whole wheat bread at Target.
Right.
You know, like, do you have two sets? Do you have the ones for the sort of big issues and ones for the small stuff?
I have one piece of paper. And on the left hand side, I have personal things. And on the right hand side, I have work oriented things. So on the left hand side, I absolutely have something like, you know, buy salmon for dinner. And then on the right hand side, you know, Sit down and think about career moves.
Did you imagine in your early 20s that you would be able to have a life where, I mean, you're teaching and raising a child, but where writing was like the focus of your working life?
I did not. I loved to write as a child, but I wasn't one of those kids who thought, I'm going to be a writer. Because I didn't really think that was possible. I didn't have any models of people who were writers. I thought it was this dreamy thing that only some people got to do. And it really was my writers group in New York. When I moved to New York, I was in my mid-20s. These were young professional writers. Many of them had published books. They took themselves seriously. We were 25. And that was the first time that I took myself seriously because they did. And that was a gift. I don't think I would have done the work to try and publish a book or develop a writing practice if they hadn't coached me.
Because it's so easy to lose confidence in yourself if someone doesn't say, absolutely, go for it.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's not only that, it's just saying you can try for this and you will fail on 1,000 levels. And what does that even mean, to fail or succeed, right? But keep trying and make this, whether you publish or not, it's a writing practice. And people often say, oh, I'm not a writer, I haven't published. And I say, do you write? Okay, well, then it turns out you're a writer. You just have to get words on a page.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who say they're writers and they don't actually write.
Exactly, exactly.
Molly Carrow May's new memoir is called The Map of Enough, One Woman's Search for Place. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Molly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. A real pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter over at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to send the show an email, you can send that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.